Welcome to the Corporate Venturing Insider Series, where I interview top practitioners in the CVC world and learn with you the best practices and golden nuggets that they have accumulated over their career. In this episode, we will be learning from Dr. Denis Charbois, Professor of Entrepreneurship at Santa Clara University. Denis, could you take a few minutes to share your story and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. Thanks, Nicolas. And it's great to be here. I'll start off. I've been around for quite a long time, as you can tell by the gray hair. I grew up in Canada, and that's where I took my undergraduate degrees in engineering. And so once you are an engineer, you're really always an engineer. You never lose that. So I moved to California for work, but then being out of school for a while creates some anxiety. So I decided to plug back into academia. I went through maybe 20 years worth of classes. I got a number of degrees, including a PhD, as a result of that. As I moved on, this was right around the late 90s, and I saw a lot of opportunities in small companies, so I decided to work for a startup. So ultimately, I got connected with a friend of mine who had started up an encryption company, and cybersecurity was always one of my passions. So we went IPO. I was in charge of corp dev in that company. So we acquired another couple of companies. And then when the bubble burst, everything just went away. So I ended up being an investment banker for a few years. And I learned in that process that most failures of incorporations acquiring companies largely stem from making the wrong choice of what to buy. I've been around enough corporate executives to know that when deal fever happens, there's very little that can get in the way of the deal getting done. But the reality is you need a framework for making these decisions. So I went through for a period of eight startups. So it was at a time when funding was very difficult. So I think three of the five shut down pretty quickly. There were two successes. Two acquisitions. The one that I think is most interesting was the one we sold to Cisco. So that was back in 2007. So it was my first opportunity to be on the receiving side of an acquisition. And having been on the corporate side and having acquired companies, I learned a lot about what not to do, because large corporations can easily kill small companies if they're not careful about bringing that into the company. So all while I'm doing this, I started teaching back in 2000 here and there, doing guest lectures. And then finally, I reached a point where I had an opportunity to join Santa Clara University and been teaching marketing and entrepreneurship and a lot of courses that are oriented towards young Silicon Valley people that aspire to be entrepreneurs.
Very nice. It's very rare for us to have people who have been on both sides of an acquisition. And so the other thing which I find very interesting is you're teaching entrepreneurship. You've been an entrepreneur. So what would you tell the younger Denis on how to select which startup to join?
I think you often don't have much of a choice. I mean, unless you're doing your own startup. But so of the eight startups, four of them were mine. I founded or co-founded. And failing in startups is one of the most important assets you will ever have when you move forward. I always said as an investor, when I was doing investing, if the leader of the startup had not failed before, I would consider that to be a disadvantage. If you had failed, then I would ask, what did you learn from the failure?
Now, you mentioned two successes out of the eight, and of course, the most notable by Cisco. I mean, it's clearly not the same as today, but can you share, how did it even start, the conversation of an M&A? It's not like a cold email.
It turned out the way Cisco typically will look for acquisitions is they have holes in their product line and they're looking for functionality that they don't have. So they'll go through a make, buy, partner analysis. And it was really through contact with one of our investors that had a prior company that sold to Cisco, that there was a connection there. And so the connection was made, and Cisco's style of acquiring is a little different than most. They will do all of their due diligence before they give you an offer. So we went through probably 6 to 9 months worth of due diligence. If you're a large company, you can do that and get away with it. If you're not such a large company, it would be difficult for the startup to feel that they were wasting their time.
And so was any of the due diligence or after the offer was made, Was there any good practice in terms of preparing you for a good onboarding?
Well, the week before it closed, they started spinning up the onboarding machine. And the first part of that was had somebody come in and talk to us about what the onboarding process would like. We were assigned an ombudsman, basically a go-between. It was somebody that Cisco assigned to us that would be our single point of contact for everything, for finance, for manufacturing, for security badges, for knowing where the bathroom is, all of that. And so it helped us navigate the complex organizational structure. Plus, they also helped insulate us from some of the other people that wanted to spend time with us. Like the manufacturing people wanted us to move our manufacturing into their standardized manufacturing operation, but we were not ready to do that. But they were able to keep us focused on our business. That was probably the best thing they ever did, was assign us that one person. And no matter what happened, we always knew who to go to get an answer.
Now, one thing you said earlier, which I want to double click because it's so important to talk about failure, and we don't talk about failure enough. Do you mind exploring and going further on this failure concept?
You're talking about the failure of picking the wrong company. Oftentimes, the selection of an acquiring target is often done through a relationship between two people in the company. It isn't done strategically. It's done through relationship. And that's okay. But the problem is that if it doesn't fit into a strategic framework, then what you risk is spending a lot of time and energy getting to a point where you realize it's not the right choice, but you're so close to the end, you just do it anyways. So what I always advocate is that you need a corporate framework to say, okay, what are our strategic goals? If you don't have the strategy, you're flying blind. And it's easy to take a technology company and justify it because the technology is cool, but you really have to look at it more than just the technology. You have to look at, what are you buying? Are you buying just the bits and bytes? Are you buying people? Are you buying access to a market that you don't have? You know, look at the culture. Those things matter, and then make sure that for each of these acquisitions, you have a standardized framework to put them through the assessment. There are a lot of companies that will overprice the acquisition because they know that it's easy to make the acquisition look accretive on paper. Because if I've got a whole bunch of salespeople and you don't, then if I bring your technology in and I give it to my salespeople, that's going to quadruple the sales that you would have had. And 6, 9 months, a year downstream, the things that you thought you wanted out of the company may have changed. A year later, you may not be in a position to judge whether or not the acquisition was successful at all because you've integrated it so much, it's changed. A lot of the KPIs and metrics that are put in place to judge the success or failure of acquisitions, they're not very good. And I think that's an opportunity for improvement for people in that business to provide better KPIs and metrics that actually matter and are resilient over the life of the acquisition once it's acquired.
So let's talk about KPIs, because one is you've been on the both sides of an acquisition, but clearly on the acquiring side, you've also been an investment banker. So what do you think would be the right direction for a meaningful KPI for an acquisition?
The only thing that matters is, does it add to customer value some way? Does it allow you to do more for the customers you have? Does it drive business growth? Does it reduce cost? The rest doesn't really matter. It's not an exact science.
So I think it's also a golden nugget, because I think what you're saying is don't even think about an acquisition-specific KPI. Look at the acquiring company KPI, the real business, and how does an acquisition improve these company-wide KPIs. But don't try to look at what the KPIs for that acquisition should be, because things change anyway.
Well, I think it's okay to have them, but don't obsess about them, because they may or may not become meaningful over time. So if you want to say, we're going to bring you in and we're going to reduce your cost by 50% over the next year, and we'll do that in these particular ways, great. That cost may not show up because it's three decimal places to the larger corporation. Those things matter, even if they don't necessarily point directly to one of those big KPIs.
Yeah. Now, there's also something else you hinted when you said the team has worked so much on an acquisition, they feel like they have to go through, which is a sunk cost. And the concept of it doesn't matter how much time you spend on something, if it's not the right thing to do, you shouldn't do it. But we're all humans and we feel like we have to do it. Is there any best practice that you found can counter this desire to close when it's really sunk cost?
Yeah, if it's a large acquisition, then it's really the board that has to step in dispassionately and look at all of the information that's presented and in a strategic framework and either give it a thumbs up or thumbs down. If it's a small acquisition and it's at a business unit level, it's going to be really hard to get in the way of that because once they get their deal fever going, then there's hardly any way to stop that. And if I was the corp dev, I would require that they hand that off very early so that the corp dev people can process that because they will find every reason to make it happen because they made the choice.
And they may have fallen in love too. So if I think about us as VC, sometimes we fall in love with the entrepreneurs and we want to invest and we start to be more irrational than we should be.
Yeah, it's some of it is unconscious. They don't realize they're being irrational, but they are. And they can put up very good arguments why the deal should go through. But there's only a few things that you need to really look at as to whether it's the right deal. And if you go down and do the due diligence and you get to the finish line and it doesn't work, then there has to be somebody that's not connected to that due diligence to come in and make that decision. You know, you've got a little bit of wiggle room, but I would say that every acquisition that's put on the table should go through a vetting process before you start down that path. Because if you're going to invest the energy as a corporation to do the due diligence, you want to get to the finish line. You don't want to go and spend $100,000 and a team of people for 6 months and then find out we're not going to do it. And when you find something out at the end that you should have found out at the beginning. And it takes about as much time to do due diligence on a big company as it does a small company. So it's easy to consume all of the energy of the CFO and the CEO of that startup, and they're not paying attention to customers. And that's their primary job.
I think that's another golden nugget, which is really isolating your team that still needs to deliver on the startup's mission while having parallel discussions about M&A. Because if that M&A doesn't happen, you don't want to have compromised your startup's progress.
And you have to be conscious of the fact one of the key functions of the CEO is to fundraise. So if he's not fundraising and he's going off trying to sell the company and that doesn't work out, then there could be a problem. What I typically do is explore with the investors the what-if scenario. What if this doesn't work out? What's our runway? In the event that the deal doesn't happen, we have at least a path where we can get additional funding.
Very nice. So I'll use that as a segue to go into the investor side. How do you work as an entrepreneur with your board and with the investors? What best practices would you suggest when you are in an M&A discussion? Is there any best practices from your experience you would share about how to handle an M&A discussion with investors and all the dynamic aspect that comes with it?
Yeah, you could have three investors and one of them wants to keep, wants to hold, wants to build to the next level of value and then think about it. And then the other ones may just want to cash out. So at the end, you need some consensus because what you don't want to do is go down a path where if it's one board member and you're outvoted and they're outvoted, then you could do that. But you don't want to be in the position where it's forced down their throat because then you could have legal repercussions as well. So I wouldn't start that journey unless everybody felt that it was either the right thing to do or potentially the right thing to do.
Very nice. And now I'm going to go backward, which is about selection of the investors. And of course, let's assume you're a startup with choices. Investors want you, which means you can choose. Let's go at the highest level, which is when would you choose a VC versus a CVC or a mix of them?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So first of all, choosing a VC is choosing a mate. You have to approach it like you're going to be married to this person. So you better get along and you're going to have a relationship with these investors where they can expose you to other customers, other investments they have, that they can bring in functional support where you need to. And what's their track record of success? And I understand their motivation. Everybody wants to make money, sure. Okay. But this is only going to happen if we all get along. Now, when it comes to corporate VCs, rarely do you get a corporate VC that will invest in order to diversify out of their backyard. You're typically filling a hole in their product line, giving them something they don't have that they have decided that the best thing to do is to buy it rather than build it because it will take too long to build. Now, as a startup, I'd say that corporate VCs can be the best match of anything because you're typically joining with them, not just for the money. You're looking at a potential acquirer. You're looking at somebody that has a vested interest in your specific domain. Whereas the VC, they're just in it for the money.
Now, let's double click. You select the corporate VC or the lead investor does because of some financial but also non-financial benefit. How do you maximize that value? How do you ensure that you get the value you expected?
Yeah. So whatever that corporate VC has done in the past matters. So you have to look at past practice. And I would go to other companies they acquired and ask questions about what it was like to get acquired. What did they do with you after they acquired? Were you happy with the post-deal integration? What was the level of support you got internally? How much did you have to compromise your vision in order to match up with their strategy? The only thing you may not do is you may not have as strong a strategic fit, because in the corporate VC world, they may keep you as an investment for 10, 12, 15 years, okay, and let you evolve and feed you things that you can do and then internalize that technology without actually going through the process of buying you because you're performing really well as a startup. So that's actually not a bad way to do it. The regular VCs, they have a timetable for sure.
Yeah. Now, with all you know, if you were to create a corporate VC for Cisco, knowing how good they've been on M&A and the corporate development team, what would be the top three or four things you would be thinking about creating a corporate VC?
Well, so there has to be kind of a strategic charter for the corporate VC. It's to do something important for the company. The financial part of it matters, but not to the extent that it compromises the strategic reason for doing this. Now, once you have that strategy and you all buy in, then I think you need to operate the corporate VC as if it were a separate entity, almost like a venture capital firm on its own. If you're constantly going back to the mothership and having to use their purchasing department or their finance department, it just slows everything down. I'm not saying have no governance, but act independently, act like a VC. Run lean and mean, run fast. The successes should be brought back into the VC organization to fuel other investments. The acquisitions that are made as a result of the CVC, some of the proceeds of that should go back into the CVC organization so they can grow as an independent investment entity.
I think you've given one of the best explanations I've heard, which is from a sequential point of view, which is start with a strategy. What's going to move the needle for that corporation? And then allow for the independence, autonomy to the extent they can be a good VC, but with a link to that strategy. And I think most people typically likes to propose both at the same time. And I think that if you're not in agreement with the strategy, there is no point to talk about all the logistical aspects.
Well, it's going to be painful for many of the executive leaders because they are going to want to exert control over the CVC organization. And for all the right reasons, but they can't, they shouldn't. And if they do, it's going to compromise the speed and efficacy of the CVC organization as a whole.
Let's double click because maybe we'll have some of the CEOs of corporations thinking about creating a CVC. And you're right. The top management, corporate officers, head of business group might want to influence that CVC. And you said for the right reasons. And yet it would be impacting negatively the potential of the CVC to bring that strategic value.
Well, first of all, there's a cultural distinction between the type of way that you manage a CVC versus a regular organization. And I would say, if you've ever read Geoffrey Moore's book, Zone to Win, it paints a really good picture of how large organizations need to subdivide into these different zones. And one of the zones that is often overlooked is the incubation zone. And he makes a really good case for why that incubation zone needs to operate independently, separately, different culture, different people, different processes. Can you do it without all of that? Sure, okay. But I strongly believe that you're going to, little by little, infiltrate the culture that makes those types of investment organizations successful, and you're going to make it less successful.
Actually, I like to think of incubation the same way as nature, which is you need to create additional protections because incubation, the start of innovation, is so fragile. And if you try to impose a big company structure on something that's very fragile, it's very likely not to survive.
Exactly.
Now, I want to ask, maybe looking back at your career, maybe one of your biggest challenge and what you learned from it.
I think what I've learned along the way, when you're looking at your career, it's never a straight line. To your point, you said earlier, sometimes you don't see how the dots connect until you're 20 years later, you see how it all threaded back. But detours can be really healthy. They can give you a new perspective. They can allow you to learn things that you never would have thought would be useful. And then as you come back, maybe on the different path, and maybe the path that you always wanted, you're bringing experience into that role that you would not have had otherwise. And it makes you a better person. Overall, in the startup world, the thing that's most challenging is to get collaboration. You spend 99% of your time trying to figure out how to get things done by influencing other people. Some of it is people in your startup. Some of it are your investors. Some of it are your customers. In large corporations, it's harder to get away from the politics. The best way to diffuse politics is to act in the best interest of the customer. So when you have the voice of the customer or are acting on behalf of the customer, all the other things don't matter. Whatever opinion somebody has about something and the way to do it, then the customer's voice always wins.
It always is. Actually, I do like the discussion we had about detour before the podcast, because if we think about diversity of thoughts, which drives better decision, the more detour you had in your career, however weird they might look at the time, brings you a different way of thinking, which you add to the team. And you could argue that when we interview and when we recruit people, we should really be excited when we see a detour and try to understand what was behind it. What does it bring to the team? So I also believe that detours are part of what makes individuals a stronger contributor to a team.
Yep. And the students in my class that are interested in becoming entrepreneurs, the first thing I say is that I can teach you how to be an entrepreneur, but I can't make you an entrepreneur. That has to be in your DNA. Because it's to learn the process and to try it, there's so much about it that is just hard on your life and everything around you that it's something you have to want to do. And they often come to me with ideas. And what I tell them is great ideas are fine. There's a lot of great ideas out there that from somebody that has been in a startup, who has invested in a startup, the idea is actually the least important part of it. It's the team and the ability to execute. I'd rather take a mediocre idea and a great team than a great idea and a mediocre team any day of the week.
I agree. And anyway, from a great team, you're not going to get mediocre idea anyway. It would be at least good idea. But I think what's interesting is that the starting idea is likely never going to be the end business.
Well, and that's one of the things we teach. Even though we require our students to bring a plan, a business plan, the business plans don't have a lot of utility in startups, other than the fact it forces you to think through processes. Who's your competition? What's your go-to-market? But ultimately, things change so quickly that you really have to be prepared to pivot, but always keeping the customer kind of the centerpiece of all of this navigation.
And also, I mean, you talk about Lean Startup, the value of that methodology is that you're testing hypothesis of the highest risk first. You're not testing randomly. You're looking at what is the highest risk I need to test next.
And something else is, especially with engineers, is they tend to overthink a lot. And they pride themselves on how much they can confuse the people they talk to. So it's their source of power. So what I always tell the students is that, first of all, communicate with people like you're talking to a third grader. If you can speak about complex ideas in that way, then everybody will understand it. And the whole analysis paralysis part of it, I always say that overthinking issues is the hobgoblin of getting things done. I would rather get it 80% right in half the time than 100% right in twice the time. Don't look for precision. There is no precision. There's no precision in markets or no precision in customer needs. Speed and agility make all the difference in the world.
And maybe this is towards my last questions. When you meet entrepreneurs, and you said you're born on that entrepreneur, how do you tell, especially across your students, who's going to be a great entrepreneur? What are the early signals you can see, and what are they?
They're passionate about whatever it is. Now, they may not have a great idea, but you can see the passion in whatever they're talking about. That they're people that get things done. They're action-oriented, they're passionate, and they are great communicators, and they're able to influence people. They lead with empathy, they lead with passion, they get things done, and they don't sweat the small stuff.
Yeah. And part of the communication, I think, is the importance of being a good storyteller. And it's not just towards investors, but customers and recruiting the first few team members is so critical.
Yeah, that's something we do teach when we're teaching how to pitch to VCs. It is all about the story. So if you don't have a story and it's threaded through everything, then things tend to fall apart in small pieces. So you're absolutely right. Storytelling is one of the most important parts of being an entrepreneur.
Well, Denis, I really appreciated your time today. I think you've shared quite a few golden nuggets, and I think your varied experience brings even more contrast to what is typically more 2D topics. So I really appreciated your time today. Thank you.
My pleasure.